to a... Right.
John Curtis, I'm the president of BC, but thank you so much for
thank you for
coming to give this lecture.
Thank you.
A very good audience, probably.
Thank you, right. I hope
we're
so.
All
well,
looking forward to it.
Very
excited.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is Andrew?
good job, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gentlemen, Lord Lamont, very warm welcome to all of you tonight. Thank you very much indeed for coming, and in particular, thank you very much indeed for booking. I know that this is a little bit complicated and quite new from long-standing members of the Institute, but as you can see tonight, and as you've been seeing over the past few events, we regularly are overbooked for these events now, and it really does help our administrative staff enormously if you do book ahead, so that we know we can make room for you, and that we can comply with the Academy's fire regulations. So thank you very, very much indeed for being so good about that. It's my great honour tonight to introduce Dr. Ali Alawi to you all. It's an enormous challenge to summarise such a varied and distinguished career, but I will do my best. Dr. Alawi began his career as a banker, having first trained as an engineer, but is also, I think, what we might call a public academic. He has written very important and erudite and well-received books. He has done a lot of media work, a lot of political work. He has served as Minister of Trade, as Minister of Defence, as Minister of Finance in the early post-war years in Iraq. He has been a visiting scholar at the universities of Harvard and Princeton, amongst other universities. He's a senior associate member of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and an honorary fellow of the Institute for Arabic and Islamic Studies at Exeter. His three most recent books, The Occupation of Iraq, published with Yale University Press in 2007, was received major acclaim and won big prizes, as it is the book very shortly afterwards, The Crisis of Islamic Civilization in 2009. I don't know how you managed to write books so speedily. I wish I could. I am very, very impressed. And tonight he will be talking to us about his current project, which is, as you know, which is why we're all here, the new political biography of the first king of Iraq, Faisal I. And the book is, as I said, a political biography setting his life against the fall of the Ottoman Empire and the formation of the modern state system in the Middle East and the formation of Iraq. So, Dr. Alami, a very, very warm welcome from all of us. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for this most kind introduction. I'd like to thank the British Institute for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to discuss what I think is a very interesting and important subject, which is the politics of archaeology in Iraq. I've just finished writing what I think will be quite a large book on the life of King Faisal I. His life, of course, spanned the most important, in fact, epical changes in the Middle East. He was born towards the last decades of the Ottoman Empire, served in the Ottoman Parliament, was involved in a number of campaigns to quell rebellions in the Asir province of the Ottoman Empire. He then was quite a firm Ottomanist in the early days of the war, and then led the military side of the Arab rebellion, becoming leader of the Arab government in Syria, subsequently king of Syria, and then after the debacle at Maysalun, basically in search of a role, and all kinds of events came together to push him to becoming, or to make him, the first king of modern Iraq. His life is really very interesting, and I hope you will find the book when it comes out next year of some interest. I chose this topic mainly in honor of the British Institute and Gertrude Bell, and I wanted to talk about something that is really outside of the realm of the conventional. I didn't want to do a plug for my book, and this will, I hope, come later, but this was a very important and much overlooked subject, which is what was the role of archaeology in the early years of modern Iraq, and how did that reflect on the way the country dealt with this important issue, and how various actors and players handled this problem or this issue. There's a picture here of Faisal and Sata al-Hasri and Gertrude Bell. Gertrude Bell, of course, needs no introduction. Sata al-Hasri, for those of you who have not heard of him before, is a very, very important, in fact, one of the most significant figures in modern Arab history. To a very large extent, he is the founder of the ideology of modern Arab nationalism. Sata is a person of Syrian origin. He was born in Yemen, though. His father was a judge there. And he rose in the Ottoman bureaucracy, in the Ottoman hierarchy, and played some important pedagogical roles in Istanbul. He was a firm proponent of the Ottoman Empire. And if, for lack of a better word, he could be called an Ottomanist, a person who believed that the Ottoman Empire was the logical and correct place for the various peoples that constituted. But just before the war, the end of the war, the end of the Great War, he had a change of heart and moved from being an Ottomanist, I suppose to some extent, seeing the end of the empire looming. He switched his allegiances and became the proponent of what I would call ideological Arab nationalism, the idea that those who spoke Arabic were a sufficient basis to form a nation, and that the commonalities between the Arabic-speaking parts of the world were a sufficient cause to push them towards some kind of political union. He then joined Faisal's Arab government in Syria, becoming Minister of Education. And after the debacle of July 1920, when the Kingdom of Syria was overturned by the French, he found himself again in exile with Faisal. He left with him, actually, from Damascus to Palestine, but then parted companies between him and Faisal. Faisal sent him to make contact with the Kemalists, who were then organizing the Turkish opposition, the Turkish national opposition to the Allies. When the Kingdom of Iraq was formed and Faisal was crowned in August of 1921, Saad al-Hasri was invited to Baghdad and became Director General of Education. Before we talk about the subject, I'd like to run down very, very briefly the history of the idea of Mesopotamia in Western history, on Western and, in fact, Arab Islamic imagination. It's a land that's associated with the beginning and end of human history. The Garden of Eden is located in many reports in southern Mesopotamia, and the revelations of the apocalypse and both the Old and the New Testament of the Bible place the end of time, as it were, in and around an imagined Babylon. And in Islam itself, Babylon, or not Greater Babylon, let's say, the area around Kufa, plays a very large part in the advent of the end of time with the coming of the Redeemer Mahdi and the battles between good and evil, between the Mahdi and the Antichrist, as it were, the Dajjal, take place in that area. And in Western, in the Western literary and artistic tradition, both the idea of Babylon and Nineveh featured very, very prominently. One of the earliest paintings that you see here is by Charles Le Brun, who was the favorite court artist of Louis XIV. And here you see the entry of Alexander into Babylon, consciously linking Louis XIV with Alexander and Babylon with wealth and power. In this country, the idea of Babylon or the civilizations of Babylon and Assyria entered into the popular imagination with the huge biblical-themed paintings of John Martin. I think there's an exhibition now at the Tate Gallery on these works, and if you have a chance, just take a look at them. Of course, his most famous paintings regarding Mesopotamia is The Fall of Babylon, which was exhibited in 1819, and The Fall of Nineveh, which was exhibited in 1828. These two added to his book, the books are written by the then British resident in Baghdad, Claudius Rich, called The Memoir on the Ruins of Babylon, fired, as it were, the popular imagination of early Victorian Britain. And it was a theme that, of course, appealed to the early days of empire in the sense that it linked these empires of antiquity with the rising British Empire. It also planted the seeds, I think, of the idea that behind the sands of Mesopotamia, there are ruins of immense significance and importance. And all one had to do was to scratch the surface to find them. This is Martin's painting on the fall of Babylon, and this is on the fall of Nineveh. As you can see, it's all kinds of gloom and doom, but the massive buildings in the background, which gives you an idea of the scale of the civilization. In the Quran, Babylon is mentioned only once, and that's in Surah 2, Ayah 102, which deals with the descent of the two angels, Harut and Marut, to earth. So it has, as it were, a sacred point that connects earth with heaven and the descent of these two angels. But generally, in Arabic and Islamic culture, the idea of these civilizations were not really conceived in similar terms as you have in the Western tradition. And the ruins, as it were not expressed in the same romantic vein as you had in 19th century European artists. They were treated sort of matter-of-factly. And whenever there were visible ruins, such as the Sphinx in Egypt or the pyramids, They were put in the category of what we call ajaib, that is wondrous things, rather than the point from which an entire civilization can be unearthed. And in the 19th century, following on this rise, as it were, of public awareness and consciousness of Babylon and Nineveh, you had an increasing interest in the possible archaeological wonders of Mesopotamia. One of the features of Mesopotamia, I'll call Iraq Mesopotamia until we get to 1920, then I'll change to Iraq, because that's what the historic name that was used, I think, by travelers and writers and also by diplomats. It was a neglected area of the Ottoman Empire, and it was relatively inaccessible. Neglected province. I mean, throughout the 18th century, Iraq was seen to be a place for exile for Ottoman officials, and they dreaded going there. There were a few intrepid travelers from the West, such as the Italian De La Vale and the Swiss-German Niebuhr. But by the late 18th century, there was enough commercial traffic to warrant the posting of diplomats in Baghdad, Mosul, and Basra. Mosul also had another interest to those from the continent. It was the site of the largest concentration historic Christians, as it were, in Mesopotamia. And the French, in particular, saw themselves as having some kind of link with this group. But the general impression of all these travelers was that there really wasn't much to see there. It was a bleak landscape of desert and scrub, and with a few bits and pieces lying around. And they gave no promise of the huge discoveries that lay just underneath the sands and scrublands of Iraq. The first person to begin to collect antiquities formally and systematically was a British resident, a man called Claudius Rich. And he developed a very important collection, which was then sold to the British Museum after his death. The French, of course, not to be outdone by their historical rivals, dispatched a man called Paul Emile Botta, who's a person of Italian origin, who studied natural history, to become France's first consul in Mosul. And Botta had been told, as it were, in Paris about the wonders under the sands of Mesopotamia by a person who had read Claudius Rich's book. So he went to Mosul, fired with the idea of digging. And in fact, he began to dig in the area around Nineveh and Khorsabad, and uncovered really major finds. The early finds of Botta are still an important element of the Louvre collection. And this is when we have the Assyrian wild beasts and winged animals and so on. And they were exhibited in France in 1846 to great public interest. At the same time, parallel to Botta's work was, of course, the work of the very famous British archaeologist, Austin Henry Layard. Layard was an unpaid attaché attached to the embassy in Istanbul, and he heard again of the wonders of the area and began his excavations near Mosul in Nimrud. His project was financed by a £100 grant from Stratford Canning, then British ambassador to Istanbul. The story of Layard's discovery, quote-unquote, of the ruins of Nimrud are really legendary. He literally stumbled on a rock that turned out to be the edge of a palace, and then history was made, as it were. And his huge monuments, getting them out of the Ottoman Empire was a chore in itself, and I think there were a number of articles, and in fact a BBC program on that recently, how he got his stuff out and was shipped to England, where it was taken by the British Museum, and around which was built its famous Nineveh Gallery. Layard went on, I think, to become Undersecretary at the Foreign Office and was knighted for his efforts. And he wrote a book which also became immensely influential, Nineveh and Its Remains. In his second expedition, Layard found the palace of Sennacherib in Nineveh and important cuneiforms, which were then related to the ones discovered in Iran and basically unlocked the alphabet and the vocabulary, as it were, of the Assyrians. With Layard's success and Botha before that, there was a scramble. As there was a scramble for Africa, there was a scramble to uncover the archaeological wealth of Mesopotamia. And the French jumped in, later the Americans and the Germans joined the race. But until 1874, there was no Ottoman law of antiquities, and it was basically a game of finders keepers. So whoever found anything could ship it out if he did suitable arrangements, as it were, with the officials on the spot. In Britain, the fulcrum of excavations in Mesopotamia was with the British Museum. I mean, they organized and sanctioned most of the expeditions or excavations that went on. But very quickly thereafter, the American Oriental Society, which was founded in 1842 and financed by tobacco money, organized its first excavations in 1884. Funding for the AOS came mainly from universities and from John D. Rockefeller, who had a great interest in archaeology, and he, of course, endowed the University of Chicago and with it its famous Oriental Institute. By the end of the 19th century, the Germans got in with the Deutsche Orient Gesellschaft, I think that's how you pronounce it, which was again dependent on private money, mainly from Krupp and the bank, Deutsche Bank. And it organized its first expedition to Babylon in 1899. By the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and the passage of a quite restrictive Ottoman antiquities law, the law of 1874, Mesopotamia, most of the excavations in Mesopotamia were being undertaken by the Germans. The French had basically packed up. The British reduced the size of their efforts greatly. And apparently it was discovered later that there was a secret protocol to the Ottoman-German treaty, which allowed Germans exemption, as it were, from the requirements of surrendering all findings to the state, which was in the 1874 Ottoman law on antiquities. In 1909, of course, Gertrude Bell visited Mesopotamia for the first time and wrote her famous travel book, Amarath to Amarath, which had large parts of it dealt with the archaeology of Iraq and Iran and Syria. And after she came back here, she also wrote a number of articles on the archaeology of Iraq and the times. And Bell's observations then was she was really aghast at the haphazard and destructive way in which diggings were done by the French and the British, and contrasted them to the methodical practices followed by the Germans. And the reason why the Germans were so good at it is because of a man called Ernst Herzfeld, who was probably the doyen, as it were, of German archaeologists in Iraq. Herzfeld was of Jewish extraction, had to leave Germany, actually, in the 1920s, but he played a large part in helping the founding of the archaeological school in Princeton and was at the Institute for Advanced Study. But his interest was eclectic. It was, widespread. It went beyond just the interest in the civilizations of antiquity. He was also interested in the Arab-Islamic era and unearthed a number of very important findings in Samarra. That's a picture of Herzfeld. Standing, I think, in front of his, one of his major discoveries in Iran, or probably Persepolis, this was. The outbreak of war in 1914 saw Britain and the Ottoman Empire fighting it out in the Middle East. There was a wholesale induction of British archaeologists into military intelligence. A large number of them joined the Arab Bureau in Cairo, which was responsible really for, this was like probably the first think tank of modern times, and was responsible for charting out British activity in the Middle East and writing really very, very important reports which have stood the test of time. People like Lawrence, who was also involved in archaeology, his boss or his tutor in Oxford, David Hogarth, Leonard Woolley, the discoverer, quote-unquote, of the ruins in Ur, and Gertrude Bell were all taken into the Arab Bureau. Even Lord Kitchener, who became the Secretary of War, was involved in archaeological work before he had done some work for the British Palestine Exploration Fund. During the war, both the British Museum and the Victoria and Albert pushed the government here to use its powers as an occupying force in Mesopotamia to basically increase their some collections, considering the items and artifacts and findings in Iraq as basically war trophies. There was, of course, the Hague Convention, which was, I think, in 1909, to which Britain was a signatory, which generally forbade the plundering or seizure of culturally significant works of art. But at the onset of war, the Germans apparently had a field day with the libraries at Louvain and so on, and looting them. So some of these restrictions, as it were, fell by the wayside. And judging the activity of the Germans in Belgium, the British Museum and the Victoria and Albert both pushed the government to follow somewhat similar policies in Mesopotamia. Of course, Mesopotamia had begun to enter into the realm of international politics. The India Office, which was the entity first responsible for managing the war in Mesopotamia. The first expeditionary force was, in fact, part of the Indian Army and was known as the Indian Expeditionary Force D. They were very, very acutely aware of the need to maintain some kind of control over archaeological items from their own concerns and experiences in India. So at the beginning, there was a kind of tussle between the India Office that wanted to maintain all the trophies, all the artifacts and items in the country, and the War Office under pressure from the British Museum to treat Iraq's archaeological findings, as it were, as fair game. Now, just you need to compare and contrast the behavior of the British Army in the period 1914-1918 in Iraq to that of the U.S. Army, unfortunately, which allowed the widespread looting of the Iraq Museum and other archaeological sites after the 2003 invasion. Now, these issues sort of came to a head when there was a large cache of antiquities that was unearthed by Hertzfeld and was on the verge of being shipped out when the war started. What do you do with this cache of artifacts? There's about 126 important findings, mainly from Samarra. And this was the beginning, as it were, of archaeological politics, but mainly, of course, conducted within the confines of the British government in Whitehall. There was very little Iraqi involvement in the design of archaeological policy, as it were. And here again, you had the War Office on one side wanting to see this as legitimate war trophy, and the India Office wanting to this cache, the so-called Samarra cache, to be kept in the country. The Eastern Committee in London, the Eastern Committee was a committee which was composed of very, very senior officials in the British government that basically formed policy in the Middle East and was the highest authority, by and large accepted that that pre-Islamic pieces could be sent to the British Museum, but any Islamic pieces and anything to do with the Arab period, the Arab Empire period, should be kept in Iraq. These issues were then synthesized by a very famous note or memo that was written by Gertrude Bell and addressed to the Eastern Committee that dealt with how do you safeguard Iraq's antiquities. Now, Bell recognized that we had to think about what to do with this in the post-war environment, where it was very likely that Britain would have some role to play in the administration of the country, and also the running of its archaeological policy. But she generally supported the Eastern Committee's decision to ship out pre-Islamic pieces to the British Museum. Curzon, surprisingly, who was then the Foreign Secretary, was very, very much against the idea of shipping any artifacts or any items outside. And he basically stood his ground. So the matter was resolved finally when Churchill became colonial secretary. And just in the twilight days, weeks before Iraq became a recognized state, the Samarra cache was shipped out by Percy Cox as basically war trophy. But I think there was a general understanding, both in the Foreign Colonial Office, because that was responsible for Iraq policy then, as well as by Percy Cox, that this was, as it were, the high water mark of sort of untrammeled export of artifacts. The Samarra cache was divided between the British Museum and 17 other institutions, mainly in Europe. And the way it was handled, and they needed some kind of ex post justification. And this emerged in a kind of odd set of articles that appeared at the end of the Treaty of Sèvres, which was supposed to be the treaty that formalized the peace between Turkey and the Allies, but it was never, of course, ratified by Turkey and fell by the wayside. This is the work that was done by Hertzfeld in Iraq in the early part of the 20th century. And of course, you know, the Malwiya was always there. This is in Samarra. But he uncovered a great deal of the palace and the surrounding walls of the palace. There was another cause celebre, as it were, affecting Iraq's antiquities in the period, and this was the so-called Lisbon collection, again mainly unearthed by Hertzfeld. There are about 448 cases of artifacts from Ashur, which is near the northern part of the country, Mosul, near the province of Mosul. And they were excavated by the German DOG before the war. They were put on ship just before the war had started, but as it was sailing towards Germany, hostilities began, and the ship had to seek refuge in Lisbon. And there was a great deal of altercations during and after the war as to who owned this, whether who was responsible for that, with Britain pressuring Portugal to cede control over the Lisbon cache. In the end, I mean, Portugal decided to keep it wisely, but parted with some of it later on to the Berlin Museum in exchange for Portuguese works of art. During the war, also, the War Office, or the occupying authority, that is the Mesopotamian Expeditionary Force, authorized excavations conducted by Hall of the British Museum and Campbell Thompson. And they exported their findings without any issue, except memos written against it by the Indian Office. Now, why did I bring this Samarra and Lisbon troves? Because they were the first time, I think, in history where a number of crucial issues were raised as to who actually owned antiquities. And there was a number of schools of thought, depending where you're from and what your interests were. I mean, were they owned by the country in which they were found? Were they owned by the nation to whom the archaeologists belonged? Were they owned by the nation or the party that funded the excavations? Were they owned by the controlling military or political power? Or were they owned by the country or countries that could best protect, preserve, and appreciate them? Now, I dare say these issues were faced in the early days of Iraq, but they're faced today. For example, the cache of documents relating to Jewish history in Iraq, who does that really belong to? Of course, Iraq said it belongs to them, but if you believe that it belongs to the country that can best protect and preserve them, then it would be somewhere else. So these issues have not yet been fully resolved. And I think in wartime, they come up to the fore in a very, very dramatic way. Faisal, of course, was crowned king of Iraq in August of 1921. And you might know that his pathway to Iraq was really extremely tortuous and troubled. It went through the Arab revolt and the problems of the Arab revolt. He was a military commander in the field. It came into who actually controlled the areas that fell under the occupation of either the Egyptian Expeditionary Force of Allenby or Faisal's forces of the Northern Army. The whole thing was his main concern in the early days was not Iraq, it was Syria. And his vision, as it were, of the Arab Near East was a confederation of states in which Iraq may have featured, but his focal point was always the Hejaz, where he was from, and Syria, or Greater Syria, which included, of course, Lebanon and Palestine. He came to Iraq as a result of the failure of his kingdom of Syria and his inability to withstand French pressures, and finally the French military onslaught by Gouraud, General Gouraud, which ended in the military disaster at Meysselun. And for a while, between around July of 1920 and the end of that year, he was at a loose end. He spent most of his time in Como or near Como, awaiting approval to cross continental Europe to meet with the various British officials, who were then beginning to seriously look at the issue of Iraq. Iraq, of course, had its own major internal uprising in the so-called uprising or rebellion of 1920. So the governing of Iraq or the governance of Iraq was up in the air. In the end, which is quite a long and complicated maneuvers and machinations that involved all kinds of people, the Kingdom of Iraq, mainly within its present frontiers, except the southern frontiers, was agreed on in the Cairo Conference of March 1921, and Faisal was invited to become king of Iraq through a plebiscite. So he came into the country really without much domestic support. His main source of support were the Iraqi officers who had been an important part, in fact a pivotal part, of the military effort during the Arab revolt. And he had a number of people from Lebanon and Syria who were close to him personally and who helped him in the governing of Damascus, who moved along with him to Baghdad to form, as it were, the beginning of a governing authority. But his power was very constrained. His role as king was very much constrained by the terms of the mandate. The mandate system was a peculiar system that was imposed on three categories of countries. The Near East, that is Iraq, Syria, what became later Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine, were given, were divided up. The Ottoman territories of the Arab world were divided up into two mandate, and given to two mandatory powers, Britain and France. And this was the beginning of no end of trouble, which we are still suffering from, I'm afraid. But in the case of Iraq, there was this mandate. And Faisal, from the beginning, refused to acknowledge that the mandate was a kind of right that was given to the Allies to be imposed on the peoples. And he was always trying to regularize his relationship with the British through treaties rather than through a mandated system. So there was this tension between Faisal on the one hand, Britain on the other hand, and the governing authority, which was the cabinet, sometimes reflecting nationalist opinion or extreme radical opinion, as extreme in the sense that it was seen as such by those who questioned the right of the Iraqi political classes, as it were, to demand independence. So all developments in Iraq in the Faisalian period, as it were, that's between 1921 and 1933, and even after that, after his death, must be seen in terms of this a three-cornered struggle. On the one side, the palace trying to exert its authority to minimize the interference by the British in the administration and running of the country. The British, through the High Commissioner and the residency, trying to maintain the rights and privileges, in particular this unimpeded access to India and control of Iraq's military resources. And the cabinet, which depended on the outcome of rather imperfect elections, sometimes had a large number of nationalists inside them who demanded the severance of any colonial, quote, relations with the British, and demanding, in fact, complete independence in terms of administration of the country. The British managed to maintain their authority and control in two ways. One, through a clause in the Anglo-Iraqi Treaty that obliged the king to seek the advice of the High Commissioner. And the other way is through the advisors that were placed in various ministries to help in the administration of the country and to upgrade their technical and administrative skills. Generally, the administrators, the advisors, were, I must say, of extremely high quality, and they played a very important part in, as it were, setting up the framework of the modernization of the country. This is a picture of famous picture of Faisal being coronated. Next to him is General Marshall, who was the head of the British Expeditionary Force. He replaced General Maud, who had died after occupying Baghdad in 1917. And behind Faisal is his advisor, the Syrian Tahsin Qadri. A few weeks before his coronation, Bell, who was then the main political advisor to the High Commissioner, Percy Cox, invited Faisal to see the ruins of Ctesiphon, where there's a huge brick arch. It's probably the largest brick arch, I think, in history, anywhere, which was the site of the Sasanian kings. And she writes letter to her father of August 6, 1921. The Ctesiphon expedition was an immense success. The word in Arabic, by the way, is Taq Kasra, which means the arch of Khosros. It was wonderfully interesting, showing that splendid place to Faisal. He's an inspiring tourist. After we had reconstructed the palace and seen Khosros sitting in it, I took him into the high windows to the south when we could see the Tigris and told him the story of the Arab conquest, as the famous historian Tabari records it, the fording of the river and the rest of the magnificent tale. It was a tale of his own people. You can imagine what it was like reciting it to him. I don't know which of us was the more thrilled. And this is a picture of the arch in 1864. It's massive. You can see the individuals, yeah? Scale. In spite of what Bell might have wanted to see in Faisal, Lawrence also wanted to see certain things in Faisal. And it was that of a considerate mentor to a star pupil. But there was never a sense that the star pupil, in fact, had his own ideas and had his own capabilities. It is true that Faisal was not a trained archaeologist, and it is true that he was not a great reader of Sumerian or Assyrian history, but he wasn't a person who was completely unfamiliar with archaeology. He always visited the Roman ruins when he was traveling in Europe. Very, very frequently, on several occasions, he would go and visit Pompeii and muse there over the ruins. So he had an understanding, as it were, of the significance of archaeology in the realm that he was going to be king of, or the state that he was going to be king of. And a proof of that really is a very important passage in the book written by Faisal's personal physician, Sinderson, Professor Sinderson. And this was when he accompanied him on a tour to Iran, and in 1930, when they just passed by the ruins near Qasr Shirin, which is on the Iran-Iraq frontier. Sinderson writes, "Naturally, I knew of Faisal's great interest in the archaeology of Iraq, but I had no idea that he had a profound knowledge of Persian antiquities. I'm sure that all of us were surprised when, standing before some ruined columns on our way to Hamadan in Iran, he delivered impromptu an erudite discourse in Persian on the Sasanian dynasty, its rise and fall. Faisal spoke with admiration of the conquests and achievements of Ardashir I and II, Shapur I and Khosru I and II. He referred briefly to the 100 years of almost ceaseless conflict with Rome, and very tactfully, as a descendant of the Prophet, of the Muslim invasion immediately following the death of Muhammad." Of course, when Faisal talked about Rome, in Arabic, Rome is Rum, and usually referred to the Byzantine world rather than the Roman Empire. Faisal actually saw archaeology primarily both as a pointer, as it were, to the achievement of past civilizations on this very landscape that he was in, and to a future of Iraq of many possibilities. And his main concern was always to draw the disparate people of Iraq, disparate groups, disparate religions, into a sense that they have a shared patrimony in this country. But he was not, and there are instances where he made it clear, he did not believe in appropriating the past, as it were, to justify the actions of the present. For example, the way that Benito Mussolini used the fascist legacy to try to expand, as it were, the new Roman Empire in North Africa or in Ethiopia. And he didn't really accept either the fanciful theories that were then presented, especially by Lebanese intellectuals, that there was a direct connection between the current occupants of a country and the historic civilizations of antiquity. There was a claim that the Maronites were in fact the heirs of the Phoenicians, and there was quite an important political movement to this effect. And later, when the Assyrians of Iraq became or part of the Assyrian community of Iraq became rebellious and pushed the claim that they are the direct heirs of the Assyrians of antiquity, Faisal rejected that notion. However, if truth be told, British officialdom in Iraq had no place in their thinking for Iraqis, and that archaeology was conceived as an entirely British-led affair. And there was, in fact, widespread prejudice against having Iraqis work in this field. And for a long time, there was a kind of dismissiveness about Iraqis interested in this field. Most thought that because of the degradation of the antiquities and the lack of attention to them, that Iraqis were somehow uninterested in their past. And, of course, all these arguments were even buttressed further by claims that Islam, because it's against the representation, or apparently against the representation of human beings, is somehow uninterested in the fate of archaeological findings and statues and so on. And it's a position reinforced by the way in which the casual depiction of the ulamas of Iraq as religious fanatics and bigots, and therefore also uninterested in maintaining the patrimony of the country. Gertrude Bell, did not share these prejudices, at least not in these terms. I mean, she had some prejudices of her own, but not necessarily about the capabilities or willingness of Iraqis to come to understand their patrimony. But and she did try to establish somehow an Iraqi presence in the field. I mean, field workers, but albeit under the hands and guidance of a British official. Generally, the mandate system for Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon was supported by the archaeological profession in the West. It was seen as a way in which the Western control over the field is maintained, and there would be no obstacles put in the way of the export of items and artifacts and so on, and that under, as it were, Western tutelage, the archaeological profession can have far more leeway in terms of excavations and so on. One of the stipulations of the Anglo-Iraqi Treaty of 1922, which regulated the relationship between the king, speaking on behalf of Iraq, as it were, and the British, was that there would be an antiquities law enacted very soon. Faisal delegated the task to Gertrude Bell, to formulating Iraq's archaeological policies and preparing a draft law. Earlier, he had approved her appointment as the Honorary Director of Antiquities. Of course, there were other things on his plate than the law of antiquities, but it was Faisal's modus operandi, as it were, to appear to accede to British requests and demands while keeping a back channel open to the nationalists. And this was always a balancing act on his part. He could push as far as he could with the British. If there was some pushback, he would relent. If not, he would move on. So it was, in my mind, a very, very clever and subtle policy, but it could easily be misunderstood and gave rise to the common accusation that he was duplicitous. And this always appears in the dispatches whenever the High Commissioner or the colonial office didn't get their way on policy matters. And I think there is a lot of evidence, circumstantial, I haven't found a smoking gun yet, is that this is the approach he used with the antiquities law. He allowed Bell to draft a law that was basically in favor of the, to a large extent, the the limited restrictions on Western archaeologists operating in Iraq, while at the same time pushing others to come up with a counter to that. The law that Bell drafted, or Gertrude Bell drafted, was much more lenient to those involved in digs, archaeological digs, than the 1874 Ottoman law on antiquities. The law itself allowed required licensing, and that the digs had to be safeguarded, but it allowed for a distribution of the findings between the archaeologists concerned and the Iraq Museum, with the right to export of the allotted pieces to the archaeologists. And the director of the museum, namely herself, would preside over the distribution in what was supposed to be an equitable way. Of course, it begged the question as to where the director's ultimate loyalties lay. I mean, she was both an Iraqi official as well as attached to the British government, not formally, but at least unofficially. So Bell's law was also greatly at variance with not only with Western practice, but also with the laws that governed archaeology, archaeological digs, and antiquities in countries that were previously with the Ottoman Empire, but had moved to being part of European nations, Crete, for example. And when she presented her draft law to the cabinet in 1922, she expected it to be easily passed. But it was resisted by two very formidable people. One of them is Yasin Hashimi, who was a very ambitious and a very intelligent political figure. He was a senior Ottoman general and only switched very late in the day to the Arab side. But he came from a well-known Baghdadi family and became prime minister and was perennially a candidate for being, as it were, the kind of Mussolini-like figure in Iraq after the death of Faisal. The other figure who stood against Bell's law was Sa'd al-Hasri, the Syrian educator and intellectual whom I talked about. Bell she was ambivalent about Yasin Hashimi. In her letters and diaries, sometimes she speaks very fondly of him, other times she doesn't quite understand him, other times she hates him, and she's quite an emotional attitude towards him. But Gertrude Bell disliked Sa'd al-Hasri intensely, and she called him a dry stick of a man. This was the least of her insults. But this really falls into the same pattern as the way that T.E. Lawrence, for example, viewed the so-called effendi classes, sort of effete intellectuals attached to Faisal, and somehow not the noble figure of the Bedouin warrior. And he disliked these types intensely, and I think Bell did too, although it doesn't come out as such, but it's quite clear where her likes and dislikes lay. And Sa'd al-Hasri was a bee in her bonnet. This is Sa'd al-Hasri in later life with his daughter and his granddaughters. He had a very tumultuous career after Iraq. He was involved in the anti-British coup of 1941 of Rashid Ali, and he was peripherally involved, but he was sacked and then stripped of his citizenship, and he ended up his years in Beirut and in Cairo. And this figure here in the middle is Yasin al-Hashimi. This figure is King Ghazi, Faisal's son. And the background is Rustam Haider, Faisal's Lebanese advisor. This one is another Iraqi prime minister, Tawfiq al-Suwaidi. But this is Yasin al-Hashimi. He died a few months after his photo was taken in 1936. The altercation between Hosri and Bell was given actually a fulsome treatment in Hosri's memoirs. She apparently burst into his office in the Ministry of Education, gave him the draft law, and says, well, we intend to have this passed very soon. And he took this thing home and took it as a challenge. And he compared her draft with the Ottoman Law of Antiquities and the stipulations of the Treaty of Sèvres. And he found them, of course, to be far, far more lenient to archaeologists, Western archaeologists, than was the case in either the Ottoman Law of Antiquities or the practice in many countries of the former Ottoman Empire. And he wrote a note to that effect to Bell and told her that this law is really very much out of tune with international practice, which generally allows artifacts and items to be kept in the country as property of the state. And she answered him, according to his memoirs, this cannot be, this cannot be. Then Husri told her, well, we have the same, what I'm proposing exists in Crete anyway. Why is Crete better than Iraq? He said, well, that's another matter. Crete is one thing and Iraq is another. Husri's memoirs are generally accurate, I must say, although the other things about his ideology one can discuss, but his memoirs are quite correct. Bell then, what she did is she saw the threat that Husri could pose, and instead of keeping the Department of Antiquities under the Ministry of Education, she had it shifted to the Ministry of Public Works, which was run by a British advisor called Wilson, who is, by the way, is I think one of the greatest architects of Iraq, in the sense that all the great buildings of 1920s and 1930s Baghdad were designed by him, including the railroad station, in a very strange style, not Anglo-Mughal, Anglo-Iraqi-Mughal, but it's still wonderful and still stands. And finally the cabinet agreed, relented. I mean, Faisal was not prepared to put up too much resistance in order to have his law of antiquities passed. It was not an unimportant issue, but it wasn't as important as other issues like conscription and so on. So he let it pass, and the Department of Antiquities went under the Ministry of Public Works, and basically it opened the door for the passing of the law, which took place 2 years after Bell had drafted it. You can see the extent of resistance. And Husri commented on this affair, says, in this way, Miss Bell got rid of me. She could then do what she wished regarding our antiquities, as the Ministry of Public Works was devoid of any patriotic directors and officials. This is a typical Husri remark. But I think the difficulties that Bell faced in having what was a sort of an innocuous law, even in the presence of a mandate and mandated power, was symptomatic of the times. And it was a rear guard action by those Iraqis, I think, who wanted to see a much more modern and equitable treatment of antiquities than what was being proposed. And I think the British basically capitalized on the weak Iraqi state and their own powerful status in the country to push a law that would not have passed muster in any Western country. And this is true generally for antiquities laws throughout the mandate period, both in Palestine and Syria and so on. They were extremely lenient to foreign expeditions in what would have not have been tolerated in the metropolitan countries themselves. But still, with all of its flaws, the laws gave some power and some recognition to the role of the Iraqi state in safeguarding and licensing and so on. But by passing a law that was at variance with international norms, it opened the door to politicizing archaeology in Iraq, and it became a very, very important issue, a contentious issue with nationalists. After the law was passed, we enter in what could be called the golden years of archaeology in Iraq, and it ended, of course, with independence. Once the antiquities law was passed, a lot of the foreign interests in excavations in Iraq were reignited. They had lain dormant and throughout the 20s, waiting for some kind of resolution. And enter the Americans. And here they came, of course, with not only with their skills and their great universities, but with their checkbooks. And a lot of money was available, not only from the Rockefeller Foundation, but from newly endowed institutions. And missions came from the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute, the Field Museum of Chicago, Harvard, the University of Michigan, and Kansas. And the traditional archaeologists associated with the British Museum had to find some way of linking with these institutions. These institutions also formed what became known as the American School of Archaeology in Iraq. And it continued really until, I think, 1990 with the Kuwait. And major finds were made in this period too, including the ones at Ur, where enormous and enormously important pieces from the Sumerian period were uncovered by Leonard Woolley. And by the end of the 1920s, there were 8 major expeditions in Iraq, excavations involving nearly all the main archaeological groups from the West. The picture of Leonard Woolley, who was knighted also later. Now, Bell, when she was head of the Antiquities Department, was responsible for implementing the Antiquities Law, which required division of the findings between the archaeologists concerned and the Iraqi museum. And it was also a litmus test, as it were, as to how she would rule, as it were. And by and large, the most valuable artifacts from an archaeological point of view were allowed to be shipped out. She tried to keep a kind of Iraqi finger in the pie by doing a joint Iraqi Oriental Institute excavation dig in Diyala. But there were no Iraqis, and the only Iraqi element were the workers and the diggers and so on. Bell died in July of 1926, probably a suicide. It's not yet certain, but it seems that she overdosed on a powerful sedative called Dial. But in her last years, I would say between 1923 onwards, she became increasingly marginalized in Iraqi politics, and to some extent became an isolated and somewhat eccentric figure. She kept, of course, her retinue of friends and contacts, and she was always the first port of call by Western visitors to Baghdad. But as her political influence waned, she became more interested in archaeological affairs. And when she died, she had left in her will £6,000, which is a large sum of money those days, to the founding of the British School of Archaeology in Iraq. I don't know if this is the Bell Memorial, but this is the source of the money, I suppose. Yeah. Faisal, who had kept his distance from Bell on political matters, although he enjoyed her company, a social company, and they went on picnics frequently together, he was very distressed when she died and asked his brother, ex-King Ali, to organize a state funeral for her. And when the Iraq Museum was expanded, he named a special gallery for her. Now, the success of these archaeological missions of the late 1920s, I mean, Woolley is a case in point, coincided also with the rise of nationalist tensions in Iraq. And there was constant wrangling between Faisal and the British regarding successive Anglo-Iraqi treaties that were supposed to lead to independence. And every time there was a hitch somewhere, tensions rose, the nationalists tried to outmaneuver and to escalate their demands. There was a great deal of hostilities and tensions in the air. And the Antiquities Law became a focal point, or one of the focal points, of the nationalist opposition. And it's the usual arguments about British plundering our treasures and the Iraqi Museum being given only inferior pieces and so on was a central element in the nationalist discourse, as it were. But it served Faisal's purpose to keep the pot boiling there. And it also allowed him, as it were, to have many points at which he can prod and push the limits of British influence. And protecting Iraq's archaeological patrimony, even though this scale of plunder was not as great as was we were led to believe, was, I think, an important political point for him. But he was also very conscious of the scientific and exacting methods used in modern archaeology and the benefits that could accrue to the country from a relatively open access to foreign excavation missions. But in the end, it was a matter of sovereignty for him, and that it is Iraqis who should devise their policies rather than to have ones that tend to favor the interests of the metropolitan power. Now, the nationalist claims of plunder and so on, if you read dispatches by British officials in Baghdad, it was all this hyperbole and irresponsible people and all of that. But actually, it became crystallized by the so-called Cook affair. R.S. Cook was an advisor to the Ministry of Endowments, the Awqaf. But after Bell's death, he became the acting or the honorary director general of antiquities. He was replaced in 1929 by Sidney Smith, quite a well-known archaeologist from the British Museum. When he was replaced, he left government service and became a freelance dealer in antiquities and advised the burgeoning American archaeological missions. And something that happened, a shipment of antiquities that was intercepted at the Iraq-Jordanian frontier after a case broke open and all kinds of goodies spilled out. And it contained a number of what I call purloined items, as well as pieces that were not properly documented for exports. And they're all destined to an American archaeologist in Beirut who was attached, unfortunately, to my alma mater, Harvard, the Harvard mission here, which was involved in one of the digs there. And he was apparently on their payroll trying to collect pieces for the Fogg Museum. Cook was hauled in front of an old British inquiry team in Baghdad, of course, away from the Iraq court system, and was found guilty and then quickly sent out of the country. But the whole affair was very, very embarrassing, and it gave fuel to the nationalist claim that Iraq's patrimony was being looted. And this issue became very significant also in the press. The Ahali group was a very influential group of intellectuals and nationalist figures. They had a newspaper of the same name. It's one of the best newspapers ever produced in the Arab world in terms of the quality of its writing and so on. And they took up the issue of the Cook affair. And a series of articles just written October 1932, November 1932, dealt with the excesses of the foreign archaeological missions and the weaknesses of the antiquities law and flagged it as one of the main issues that detracted from Iraq's sovereignty. But still, the 1924 Bell Law was still operating. And however, when the new education minister came, this is in the first post-independence cabinet, Faisal was still king, the Minister of Education, Mr. Abbas Mehdi, took a very strong line against the export of any antiquities. And it is clear he was encouraged in this attitude by Faisal. The prime minister of the period was a man called Naji Shoukat, who was sort of a colorless technocrat. And he was completely dominated in his policies by Faisal. Now, Mehdi blocked the export of any of the items that could have been exported under the antiquities law. His major encounter was with the archaeologist Max Malawan, who was actually Agatha Christie's husband. Any of you has read Murder in Mesopotamia, it deals not with Abbas Mehdi, but with the excavations at Ur. And blocking these exports created a sort of a sensation amongst the archaeologists working in Iraq and further afield. This is a picture of Max Malawan. You can't see much of her face, but yeah. Now, the British Museum started a campaign, both in London. I mean, the Times carried a number of very sort of very fervent articles and letters to the editor and thundered away about why this was destroying archaeology in Iraq and why it needs to be immediately addressed. And the argument that was made it's remarkable how the world has changed, but that, or not changed, as the case may be, that Iraqi politicians were only interested in bullion value of the artifacts. I mean, this is maybe true in special conditions, but generally you can't say that about a political class. And that the foreign missions were included responsible archaeologists and scientists, and they were best placed to preserve Iraq's antiquities, that restricting exports would stop missions coming in, and that, above all, the economic argument that was trotted out, is that by stopping these missions from coming to Iraq, Iraqi peasants would not have work in the off-season. The Iraqi Foreign Office, I mean, so presented these cases through Francis Humphrey, the then ambassador. He was high commissioner and became ambassador. And pushed to keeping, as it were, a liberal interpretation of the law open. But there was very little conviction. I don't think he himself was convinced of this argument. And I think they were aware that it was a matter of time before the 1924 legislation would be overturned or annulled. Faisal died unexpectedly in Bern, Switzerland, in September of 1933. There's a whole episode that dealt with the way he died and the circumstances of his death, which were very unusual. But in the end, I don't think there was foul play, but he was basically killed by overwork, I think, and by the constant crises that faced him. But with his death also, you removed a very important mediator and interlocutor in Iraq between various competing interests. I mean, albeit he had this single-minded focus on the country's independence, but his death removed, I think, a pivotal figure and basically in Iraq's destiny. I mean, every biographer is supposed to become enamored with his subject, but I think there's very good reason in this case. If you read the biography as history, you'd find that this would be the case. One of Faisal's close aides and followers, Ali Jodet, who was an officer and an important figure in the Arab revolt and minister often, became prime minister in October 1934 and appointed Sa'd al-Husri to the post of Director General of Antiquities. It's kind of sort of sweet revenge on the part of Husri. Now, Husri had always kept a sort of rear guard action against the law and involved himself in the politics of Iraq's archaeology. He kept on sending memos. If you read his book here, which I have here, he reproduces really a whole series of notes and letters and so on that he bombarded politicians and parliament, specifically regarding the abuses of the archaeological law, of the law of archaeology, sorry. And he, but when he became director, and was the old law was still there, he had to divide the findings of the Oriental Institute, which is a counterparty. And he really ruled massively in favor of Iraq. And this added even more shock and horror to the archaeological community. The British Museum escalated its campaign by boycotting this time Iraqi excavations. And it's note, if you read some of the documents that they, letters and notes that they sent to the Foreign Office, I mean, they were not imperialist such, they were quite racist, some of them. They're saying that while it's acceptable for Greece and Italy to have a restrictive antiquities law, because they're, after all, founding members of Western civilization, somehow Orientals, this was how Iraqis were referred to, Orientals should not follow suit. The interest in their civilization by the West would only be sustained if they opened the door to exporting antiquities. I think the Foreign Office then gave up on the British Museum and ignored these claims. Husri, though, had another very strong point of contention with the archaeological profession, and that is it was interested nearly exclusively, apart from Hertzfeld, in the pre-Islamic antiquities of Iraq. There was very little interest in the Islamic and Arab aspects of civilization in Iraq. He called the civilizations of antiquities dead and mummified. But he still wanted to maintain them as part of Iraq's patrimony, but he wanted to emphasize far more the Arab-Islamic aspects of it, primarily in order to meet his objectives of using archaeology as a tool to promote Arab nationalism. And to him, archaeology was a means of studying the past to increase the feeling of Arab consciousness and identity. And even though he himself was extremely secular in his orientation, he was very much influenced by German romantic idealists, Fichte and so on. And to him, Islam was a way of an expression of the Arab genius. But in any case, he, during his long tenure as director of antiquities, for nearly 7 years, until he was stripped of his citizenship, he expended nearly all his department's resources on the Arab and Islamic excavations. And he finally engineered the passage of a new law in 1936, which effectively banned the export of any antiquities over 200 years old. He and others were also shocked by the lack of interest in Iraq's Arab Islamic patrimony. And he brings up many cases where buildings from the Abbasid period were falling apart and they were completely ignored by the Department of Antiquities. Any calls to expand the scale of the diggings of the Abbasid palace in Baghdad or the Mustansiriya palace were met with deaf ears, basically. I can't really talk about Husri's period as director general because it's outside of the scope of this lecture. But I can bring it to a conclusion, I hope. And the history of modern archaeology in Iraq is intertwined with both 19th century attitudes to archaeology as a form of, as it were, imperial entitlement, and to the French as part of a civilizing mission, as well as the rise of national consciousness that saw archaeology as an important element in constructing identity and a shared vision of a country's past and destiny. Now, most of the Victorian assumptions that underlay, as it were, 19th century archaeology were laid to rest in Southern Europe and Turkey, but they continued in a modified form in the, for lack of a better word, the semi-colonial era of the Mandate period in the Middle East. And I think this three-way division, as it were, of perspectives on the role of archaeology in Iraq manifested the three different attitudes towards it. Bell, or let's call it the official position, she saw herself as both a protector of Iraq's legacy as well as an enabler of archaeological missions that would uncover more of this legacy and be rewarded for their effort. Husri, on the other hand, saw in archaeology as really as a means to increasing the growth of Arab consciousness in a diverse country. And he was really unconcerned with what Western archaeologists thought if they stood against this. I think Faisal's position was far more nuanced than any of them. And to him, archaeology was not about establishing the Arab identity of Iraq, but it was to do with Iraqis having pride in their legacy and feel possessors of it in its entirety. So an Iraqi would feel proud of the Assyrian legacy as he would that of the Abbasids, as he would that of the Sumerians, as he would that of the Babylonians, rather than pick and choose ones that tend to confirm his own particular identity. He also believed that the West, of course, could play a vital part in building a cadre of trained Iraqis, archaeologists, and could help in transfer of skills and best practice. But this did not give them any special rights or privileges. And these rights and privileges could only be tolerated for the duration until full independence and sovereignty is achieved for the country. With this, I conclude my talk, and I thank you for being patient.
Dr. Alawi, thank you very much indeed for that very rich and full lecture. I'm sure there are lots of questions, but I'm also aware that we have reception to go to, and I'm sure you would also welcome a drink. So does anyone have any quick questions for Dr. Alawi? So Lauren has the microphone, so please, can you, no, we're recording the thing, so it's important to speak into the microphone.
Thank you very much, Dr. Alawi. Subh al-Azawi, a Baghdadi. How do you compare the excavations which were done by the Germans 12 years where Robert Koldewey was there? How much did they take out of Iraq compared with the British ones?
Are you talking about before the war? Well, the Germans took everything out. I mean, because they had the authority under the secret protocols of the German Ottoman Treaty. So all the caches that were the Lisbon caches and the Samarra caches were most of their findings. They did not leave anything for the Ottoman state at that point. Also all the findings before the war.
They were more guilty.
Yes, I think. I mean, if that's the case, they were. Yes, they were more guilty because of these secret protocols.
Anybody else? No. Okay. Well, there will be plenty of opportunity to talk to Dr. Alawi over drinks. But before we move to the back room, I'd like to call on Institute Council member and former British ambassador to Iraq, Edward Chaplin, to give a vote of thanks on behalf of the Institute.
Well, thank you very much, Eleanor and Dr. Alawi. Thank you very much for a fascinating lecture. I think you can tell from the rapt attention and the pent-up questions that you'll probably get afterwards, including from, I see, at least two other former British ambassadors in Iraq here. I think you have used the theme of politics of archaeology to illuminate in a particularly fascinating way the history of Iraq and indeed the history of the UK-Iraq relations and the way in which it became a symbol of the Iraqi struggle for independence, which Faisal conducted in a way that you've described very, very, very well. My own first memories of archaeology in Iraq go back to the 1950s, where I was as a child with my father, who was a businessman, and the impact of something like the Arch of Ctesiphon or the Ziggurat at Samarra absolutely compelling and drove my interest in the Middle East, and I ended up 40 years later as ambassador in Iraq, where archaeology, I must say, wasn't the major theme. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to work together. I had a lot to do with another Alawi, who was the Prime Minister, no relation, I think. But it was a reminder. Actually, the only archaeological theme that came up was the alleged danger of destruction of Babylon. Actually, I think Saddam Hussein had also done quite a lot to destroy Babylon with his sort of rebuilding, and you didn't get onto that period of Iraqi history, although you would have been here for another hour, but although very fascinated. So thank you so much for choosing a theme which has so powerfully illuminated and I think fascinated all of us, and I'm sure there will be lots of questions at the reception afterwards, which we should now let you escape to. Thank you.